Hi, everyone. This is Dean Haglund from the offices of Rational Exuberance North, here in the heart of Los Feliz, California.
This is the post-production facility.
Yes, it is.
For Rational Exuberance.
As we desperately cut our documentary together in the last final seconds before going to post-production sound.
Post-production sound, absolutely. Yes. Next Monday.
Absolutely. I'm Dean Haglund, of course, and this is my fellow co-host and co-producer, co-editor, Mr. Phil Lerness.
Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour
is what you're listening to.
And October here in the United States is National Domestic Violence Awareness Month.
I didn't know that. And it was also Columbus Day, though, as I call it, Leif Erikson Day. And Canadian Thanksgiving yesterday.
Our listener and friend Torfin in Norway.
Yes.
He had a great suggestion for celebrating Columbus Day by going into other people's homes. And, celebrate, honor Columbus Day by going into other people's homes and telling them they have to relocate. That'd be fun.
Which
always beats what I usually do, which is just, commemorating Columbus Day by spreading syphilis.
is that you doing that? I didn't realize that was you.
I watched a little bit of the Atlanta Braves and the San Francisco Giants.
Oh, yeah.
The baseball game last night.
I cut sports out of my life.
Atlanta eliminated game 4 of the National League Division Series between the Giants and the Braves. Anyway, there is no more annoying sight or sound in all of sports. I'll just say all of sports. Let's just keep it there.
Let's keep it there.
Then this cheer that they do, you've heard of the wave, of course.
The
wave. Of course, you're familiar with the World Cup, the blowing of those
the
horns.
The vuvuzelas?
In Atlanta at Turner Field, and before that, when they played at Fulton County Stadium, Brave fans do something called the tomahawk chop.
The classic tomahawk chop. Turner, Jane Fonda,
exactly,
everybody does that.
Along with the chanting, the attempt at the Native American sounding war path chant, cry. And anyway, if there is anything more annoying in all of sports than seeing, really, let's be honest, 40 to 50,000 white people doing this chant and chop, I don't know what it is. And if it could be possibly more offensive than doing it on Columbus Day. On national television.
Wow, that is...
Am I wrong? No. I mean, isn't that...
No, but you know what is more offensive? I think throwing octopus on the ice at the Pittsburgh Penguin game. That was a big thing back in, the 90s maybe? For some reason, I think there was a player who had like octopus or something. And so they would actually bring...
Live octopus? Octopi?
Octopi from their local... but it'd be whole entire ones and they'd chuck it on the ice. And then they'd have to stop the game, and they bring the shovels out and Zamboni and have to clean the ice of octopus.
I don't know. I gotta.
You gotta say the tomahawk is weirder.
I don't know whether that is insulting to any indigenous culture.
How about the octopus? Is that insulting to them?
Did we relocate them to?
Yes, we did, with our destruction of the coral reefs around the world.
As I was saying, October, National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. I also think it's very interesting that breast cancer awareness month also
same time.
It falls at this time.
History Month? Is it Czech Week?
Forbes Magazine released their list of the 100 most powerful women in the world.
Oprah Winfrey. Number one.
Are we taking guesses?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Let's chat. Let's dish about the babes. there is much to actually discuss about this list to be, I don't know whether to be concerned about it, troubled by it, but bothered, or who cares what Forbes says. I don't know. But number one on the list, Michelle Obama.
What?
First lady. I don't know. Maybe that's an annual thing. This is the first year I can ever really remember paying particular attention to
this. Don't think why you... I don't know how possibly you could even be concerned about this.
I'm aware... every year of the annual, women in Hollywood issues and things like this. But so Michelle Obama, maybe it is a traditional thing with the first lady.
Don't remember Laura Bush ever being there.
And certainly, if you go back second Reagan administration, certainly one can make a very big case that Nancy was incredibly
just
influential.
Say no campaign.
Well, the whole you know, idea of bringing the wall down. I mean, you know, that she saw that an end to the Cold War was going to be her husband's legacy.
Right.
And
she also contacted the astrologist to make sure they signed the peace agreement.
I think the word's astrologer.
Isn't it a gist?
No.
An astrologer?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
Yeah, an astrologer. Yeah.
Then what's an astrologist?
I don't think there is such a thing.
Really?
Yeah.
Well.
Maybe you're the astrologist.
Because I partake? Anyway.
What? Hello, so much. We're learning so much.
Partake in the astrology. Anyway, so powerful
limit.
The peace agreement was signed after the wall came down at 3:33 p.m. specifically on a specific date because of Nancy Reagan consulting this astrologist person.
And certainly, you know, it's been well documented the ways that she protected her husband.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, you know, this early in his first term after the assassination attempt, she really became very protective of him. And apparently there are, you know, reports and that he started to even show signs of Alzheimer's when he was president. And so, again, she became very protective of him. So her influence was very well felt. Anyway, so for whatever reasons that Forbes listed, Michelle Obama is listed as the most powerful woman. Number three was your Oprah Winfrey.
My Oprah Winfrey. Why is she mine?
Now, this is where, though, my troubles with this list begin. Why I feel uneasy about this. You've got Oprah Winfrey at number three. Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State of the United States of America, number five.
That troubles you?
Well, yeah. I don't know what about it troubles me.
Yeah.
You know, but it really is interesting that, you know, you've got, I mean, Secretary of State is a powerful position. Talk show host.
Yeah, but, I mean, she sells a lot of books.
Yeah.
She influenced a lot of things.
Powerful.
Powerful.
And even at number three, though, third most powerful woman in the world, she couldn't take on the American beef industry and win, could she?
She did so win.
Did she win?
Yeah, she won that. She went down to Texas and won that court case.
Did she win, though, or did the court decide in her favor? I mean, all that time,
that
money, all that.
I am sorry. She walked into the middle of Texas, for crying out, a beefsteak, cow-loving area, found a jury of whatever, and convinced them all that she, whatever, either won and or ruled in her favor on her comments.
Yeah, I'm just saying this. No, I mean,
now, that's power. I'm sorry, that's not, I think you're missing.
Is that about, or at the same time, I mean, isn't it the hugest drag, though, to even be in that situation?
Absolutely hugest drag.
You know, where you said on your show, like if you said on Chillback Hollywood Hour, I will never eat a burger ever again. I would never, under any circumstances, eat a burger, which is what she said.
Yeah.
And then you get sued, and the next however many months of your life are spent in a court proceeding over whether or not you get to say what you said about your feelings about beef.
Yeah, but that just
on
proves
your own show.
There again, you're proving the point of how powerful she is. That the very fact that her feelings influences an entire industry.
Yeah, well,
right?
Well pointed.
And then she then goes defends her feelings and wins.
That is such a good point that you know what I'm going to say? It's astrologist.
Another one for Mr. Hagland. Racking them up.
So, anyway, still, you know what I'm saying. The idea of Secretary of State.
Yeah.
But,
you know, this sounds like the same argument when Charlie Chaplin signed his very first film contract for $600,000 for a year, and the country was outraged because an actor was making more than the president.
Okay, then let me go one step further. How about at number seven, Lady Gaga? We have women around the world that are the heads of their nations.
Mm-hmm.
Lady Gaga is number seven. Now, I am glad for something about Lady Gaga being on number seven,
mm-hmm.
Because it's the first time I realized that Lady Gaga is in fact a woman. I did not know this. I've missed the whole Lady Gaga thing.
The Lady Gaga boat.
So apparently, Lady Gaga and RuPaul are not the same.
No, Lady Gaga is a 24-year-old songwriter.
Not a female impersonator.
Not a female impersonator. No, I know.
I've missed out.
I think maybe you saw a female impersonator doing Lady Gaga.
I just have no, like, I wouldn't be able to tell you a song that Lady Gaga sang. I wouldn't. Number seven, seventh most powerful woman. Powerful woman. So hats off to you, my Lady Gaga.
Well, and what a wider range of hats to choose from to take off for her.
I have a veritable haberdashery here in Los Feliz Villages, Rational Exuberance North.
I was thinking more of her hat collection.
Oh, I thought my hat collection.
No, while yours is very lovely, hers is quite extravagant.
So again, though, we get back to this Ellen DeGeneres.
Yeah.
Number 10.
Mm-hmm.
Nancy Pelosi, number 11. So, Ellen, daytime talk show host, more powerful than the Speaker of the House, the top legislator of the United States of America.
Now, at a lame duck Congress.
But now, no, I understand this. I'm not saying that Nancy Pelosi herself should be more powerful. I'm not saying it's a bad thing if Nancy Pelosi perhaps doesn't have as much power as the position might usually afford. I'm not making a commentary politically on Nancy Pelosi. God knows I'm not.
Right.
I'm just saying the idea that we are in a culture where talk show host, more powerful, daytime talk show host, more powerful than Speaker of the House, certainly is a commentary, good, bad, otherwise. It is a commentary on where we're at societally.
Well, absolutely, because we get our information from mediated sources, that being our podcast, for instance, television, these sort of things. And so the only way we learn about how laws and all these things come through a mediated source, television, news, or radio. Ergo, anyone who controls that mediation has more power than the person could do in the law.
And, you know, it also is true and reflective that power is not necessarily directly linked to your job.
Right.
Right?
That's right.
Right. How much are we all have power? How much are we in our power?
Wow. Let's think about that.
How much are we authentically in our power? And, of course, our power directly relates to our ability to transform any energy. That's fundamentally our most important level of power. How truthful and authentic are we about who we are? That's another big source of our power. Because, again, as we've talked about over the last few weeks with, you know, criticism and things like this, right?
Yep.
The only times that external voices bother you is when you have that voice yourself about yourself. You know.
Like the parallel between me and David Lynch.
Oh, that people did not witness. That was really fun.
That's right.
For those of you who are scoring at home, I just pointed out, and Dean acknowledged it with a doff of his imaginary cap, that one of the reasons that he has great animosity towards David Lynch, because this is always how we know. It's not, look, I don't enjoy that person's work, or right. I don't, you know, it's like Lady Gaga. I don't know Lady Gaga's music.
Right.
I don't know whether it's good or bad or whatever. I don't know it.
You probably heard it and not realized.
And I might not have enjoyed it. Right. I probably heard it. It's not for me. You move on. You know, we only really form an intense judgment about things that trigger voices within us.
Right.
And so, you know, you don't waste your time with you know, people that you know are, you know, criticism that you know isn't true doesn't right. bother you ever.
Right.
Ever. Why would you waste your time on something like that? Well, so with you, with David Lynch, it's not simply that you don't enjoy his stuff. Because that's kind of a big oh well, right? You really have an
issue
energetic animosity towards his approach.
His creative process that I've seen his live Broadway shows.
And what I realized yesterday, fully for the first time, was that you were the David Lynch of improv comedy. That the very thing that you detest about him in narrative works...
Mm-hmm. is exactly what I do in my improv.
Is very much what you do in your improv.
Yes, and I break all the rules and all the structures.
All stream of consciousness.
All stream of consciousness.
A refusal to prepare. A refusal to stick to a structure. You know, I mean,
well, no,
you've even described with David Lynch that it's very much just throwing paint on a wall.
Yeah, well, I don't do that per se.
Anyway, we're going a little far afield. Yeah. But
let's talk to our readers.
But this whole idea, of course, getting back to the idea of power,
right.
Of authentically, truthfully being yourself, right. And being in your power.
That's
you
why
can
I was gonna
certainly
bring it up.
You can certainly not argue that David Lynch, at times, even if you don't enjoy the film, it is very clear what films David Lynch is in his power. Versus films where he is not in his power, where David Lynch is trying to perhaps be someone he's not.
Then perhaps this is why the Forbes list is bugging you, that you yourself have a power issue going on in your own life and then seeing it reflected in the thing.
Well, you should be more specific then, absolutely. the idea of, because what did I bring up? The issue of power that is inherent ranked. Within us being authentically ourselves versus the power of a position that you are in. And that absolutely is a struggle for me. You know, why do I not stay long in, and you can relate to this, why do I not stay long in corporate settings?
Right.
For example, even in, achieving a certain level of power within a corporate setting, why do I not, and I find those kind of settings and the power that comes, accompanying those, to be sort of restrictive to authentic expression.
Right.
And I struggle back and forth with that. That's absolutely true. And why is it, we need to interpret everything as if it were a dream.
Right.
Because the true meaning of everything can, for us personally, can only be found that way. And so, again, it's a list of women, of powerful women. So what would that be in my dream? Well, again, when we interpret, the feminine, we really do think of creative power.
Right, right.
You know,
so this
is
all about
and things. And so that, again, relates back to me.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Look at what we've just done.
See?
Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Helpful therapy sessions for all our listeners.
One last thing, and this got into a discussion that I had today, and I really thought that this was interesting. You know, the people that I was discussing this list with, said, oh, please tell me Sarah Palin's not on the list. And of course, Sarah Palin's number 16.
16.
Yeah. And, and there's so much animosity towards Sarah Palin.
Yeah.
I'm not the biggest Sarah Palin fan in the world.
I've heard that.
But I don't know if you've been following the gubernatorial race here in California.
Little bit.
Meg Whitman versus Jerry Brown.
Jerry Brown versus Meg Whitman.
Whitman. Formerly of eBay.
Right.
Who's, the founder and chairman of eBay, came out endorsing
founder?
Jerry Brown.
Yeah.
No, she's not.
Right. Oh, the actual founder.
Yeah, came out endorsing Jerry Brown.
Yeah, that's tough.
Anyway, her commercials and everything. I've been watching these commercials, and it was very interesting because say what you will about Sarah Palin versus a Meg Whitman. Meg Whitman's been a CEO. She's been successful in business. Sarah Palin was a bad
mayor.
Governor
who
didn't even fulfill a full term.
Right.
Turn pundit. And but I will say this, as a public figure, as a political leader, Sarah Palin can at least do the easy things like getting someone to do her hair and makeup, as opposed to Meg Whitman in these commercials.
Yeah.
And why is that important? Maybe it's not important. Maybe that's all superficial. It's style versus substance. Maybe all that is true. However, you and I both know, especially in the corporate world, especially in the modern world, where you're under such intense deadlines all the time, right? Things are speeding up more and more and more. There's more and more pressure all the time.
Right.
The people you gravitate to are the people you know are going to get the easy things right.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if they can't get the easy things right, what faith can you have that they're going to get the difficult things right?
Mm.
It's like spell check,
right.
Like if I get a letter from two people applying for a job and one is filled with spelling errors, you know what? The other one seems better, even if the content of the one with spelling errors, even if the ideas are brilliant in the one with spelling errors, because every machine on the planet has spell check.
Right.
If you couldn't hit the spell check button, if you were in too much of a hurry or too much of a rush to do the easy things, then how can I truthfully expect you to do the hard things? Well, and it's not always fair. It's not always fair.
I'm saying,
because as we know in art, right, brilliance sometimes needs sloppiness.
Right.
I do, though, expect, and when we're talking about politics and everything, you're talking about basically management skills.
Yeah.
A lot of times we're not really electing visionaries, we're electing functionaries.
Yeah.
And you kind of at least want these people to function.
So what you're saying is she should have got a stylist and some makeover people to basically redo that image that is Meg Whitman.
I feel like she's undone the image look not made up and to look not like that, so that she'll look like one of the people.
Oh.
She doesn't look like a billionaire who can afford expensive clothes and good makeup and hair.
Oh, I see.
Looks like just one of the normal folk.
She's downdressed in order to be Joe Lunchbucket.
You know, as if normal folk...
Don't dress up.
You know, don't dress up. And don't rise to the occasion of being on television or, you know, having any sense of decorum, as if the quote-unquote normal folk, if they could afford good clothes or could afford a expensive hairdo and right. this, wouldn't take advantage of that opportunity.
Look at People's Court, for crying out loud. Those people, come on, they're dressed to the nines, even though they're complete idiots.
You know, and so again, with Sarah Palin, the comparison, you know, it's like, If you can't do the easy stuff like your hair and makeup, you know, how can we expect you to do the hard stuff, which, of course, you know, Sarah Palin, I mean, would you be, know, I guess, forming complete sentences and reasoning.
It's funny.
I'm
torn between calling you sexist and or going, yes, equating the Kennedy-Nixon debate that was first televised, where he, you know, if you heard it on the radio, it sounded like Nixon won, but to watch it. Because
well,
Nixon,
you know,
didn't
I always
shave.
Open a can of whoop ass for myself, making people angry about, you know, the things that I say, because I like playing devil's advocate, and of course I like expressing opinions that aren't necessarily ones I agree with. I love expressing those opinions because I love working our way around to that truth that we can all agree upon, hopefully, that renders the whole conversation and debate about meaningless things ridiculous. I mean, like, you and I had that wonderful talk when we were driving the one day about, you know, the truth over what happened on 9/11, you know, and the whole debate that people will get into about, you know, was it a false flag operation? Was it all these things? And the thing that tires us so much is that people who really, all of us that ought to be on the same side, spend all our time debating that instead of acknowledging the truth, which is, you know what, it doesn't matter whether you believe that it was our own government that did it or whether you believe the terrorists did it. The important question is, do you believe that these kind of wars are ever all right?
Right. That
you
the
know,
morality
do you
is
believe
a bigger thing.
That we can ever trust the reasons we're being given to go to war when there are massive global corporations that are profiting to the tunes of trillions of dollars over the murder and of innocent people, over the destruction of cities and entire societies? Can
and you're
you
talking,
ever trust the reasons that are being given? You know, like, these are the questions that, you know.
Yeah, and there you're the speaking other, of Kaiser Permanente's CEO making $1 billion a year on healthcare coverage. So,
you know, and so the questions, again, always are important. Like, it's not to say that who is responsible for those events is not an important question to ask. It is an important question to ask. The sense of justice is an important one. You know, bringing people to justice, saying that doing this sort of thing is against the law that we have all agreed upon, that, you know, holding bad behavior accountable is important.
Right.
It should never, the debate over that should not keep those of us, the vast majority of us, who have so much upon which we can agree, it shouldn't keep us from getting to those issues. And really, because again, the powers that be, the people that profit from things that we can all agree we don't want, those people only gain by our constantly debating,
fighting
over this thing over here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So now when we bring it back to this issue over, you know, the am I being sexist or am I making a good point? Why does it have to be this or that?
Right.
You know,
it could be this and that.
And again, you know, I'm sometimes funny to a point that gets myself in trouble.
That's the kind of comedy we do here.
But let's face it, you know, it is true of men also. I mean, we're talking about women because it's a power
issue
with women. But let's face it, with men, it doesn't matter how smart you are as a political figure. You wear bow ties. There's only so far you're gonna go. Right?
Yeah.
Yep. Powerful men don't wear bow ties.
Not anymore.
Right?
Did they ever?
I don't know. I
name
don't know.
One powerful guy in a bow tie. Pierre Burton?
No. Well, I mean, James Bond. Booyah, that just happened. So if you're wearing a white dinner jacket to Congress, then you have the license to kill.
See? Awesome. Hey, don't we have...
We have so much discuss, so much show business news even.
Let's do show business news really quickly and get to it.
Well, no, we've got everything. Well, that includes the show business. It's all about show business from here on in. As was that power list, by the way. I mean, Lady Gaga is number 7. We're the most powerful business in the world. It doesn't matter that we don't generate that much revenue,
right?
The entertainment industry, when you compare it to any other industry, but apparently we're powerful.
Power.
One thing I left off the Tony Curtis remembrance last week.
Yeah, what'd you forget about remembering?
One film that people might want to see. It's a small film. It was made by the great director Nicholas Roeg from 1985, Insignificance. Do you remember this?
I do, sort of.
Four very famous figures
came
together in a hotel during the height of the Cold War.
Oh, yeah.
Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah.
Joe DiMaggio. Albert Einstein and Joseph McCarthy, Senator Joseph McCarthy, famous for the communist witch hunt.
And they were all in a room together.
And Tony Curtis plays Senator Joe McCarthy.
No.
And it's a really interesting film.
Wow.
Marilyn explaining the theory of relativity to Einstein.
That's right. I remember that.
That's a delightful, undervalued gem.
Right. That was quite an art house little, the beginning.
And Tony Curtis was really extraordinary.
Yeah, yeah. Insignificance.
Insignificance. So
fantastic.
Little final farewell to to Tony. You know, it was the 70th birthday of John Lennon.
Oh, yeah.
This week. Talking about someone who kept trying to elevate the conversation.
Right.
Who would stir things up, make statements that intentionally to play devil's advocate.
Right.
To rile people up.
More popular than Jesus.
And yet someone who always advocated civil disobedience. Mm-hmm. Who believed there was no excuse for bad behavior.
Right.
Who
certainly anti-war.
And not just anti-war, but peace. He advocated peace.
Right.
You know, we've so lost the idea of embodying the message that we're trying to send.
Right.
You know, the example that I love are you'll see these people in public areas honk for peace. Do you not understand that you were arguing against peace? Do you not understand that you were embodying the opposite message of what... Do you mean peace or do you mean... You're anti-war because those are not the same thing. The absence of war is not equal to peace.
Mm.
Honking disturbs the peace.
Right. You get a ticket for that.
So disturb the peace
for peace.
Yeah. What?
Makes no sense.
Right. I mean, and that's the thing, right?
Like
if you are using violence to combat violence, you are not combating violence. You're combating the people who are utilizing violence.
Right.
If you are using fear to combat fear, you're not. You're exactly the same as the person you're fighting.
Right.
You're just arguing over, you know, you're just haggling over the price.
Right.
You know, what you're basically saying is that ends justify the means, that we can use fear, we can use violence as long as our cause is just.
Right.
Ends justify the means is what you're arguing. And so Lennon was someone who really understood, you know, to embody the message.
Right.
And so anyway, his 70th birthday was this week. And I, again, troubled by the fact that on the week of Lennon's 70th birthday, the Beatles' record for most hot Billboard Hot 100 singles
is broken.
Was broken. They had 71 Hot 100 singles. You know, and they were only together, what, recording for 8 years? Mm-hmm. Hot 100 singles, 71. Most ever by a non-solo act.
Right.
That record was broken this week by the cast of Glee, who had 6 new Hot 100 singles debut on the charts this week, bringing their total to 75.
And those were all Britney covers, weren't they?
17, I think, were Britney covers.
Yeah.
Imagine what will happen when they start getting into Beatles covers.
Wow.
They will...
knock off...
it'll go to infinity.
Right.
This one goes to 11.
So basically, they can go through the last 100 years of Billboard charts and do all the top 10 hits, and there will be 1,000 hits.
What's
strong.
Incredible about this is that the show is only it just entered its second season.
It's a second. Do you watch the show? No. I can't. You know, I was in theater in high school. The show should be aimed right at me, and I, for the life of me, cannot get into it.
There's a few episodes that I want to go back and I want to watch, like when Neil Patrick Harris guested.
Yeah.
Javier Bardem's episodes.
Maybe.
You know, and I feel like you can get in and watch episodes and you don't need to have been with the whole show.
Yeah, no, it's kind of self-explanatory. Oh, well.
So that was big news. Anyway, we left a question unanswered.
Yes.
From last week from listener Paul Tolton.
Uh-huh.
About a new genre called docu-thrillers.
Docu-thrillers.
He's dubbed them docu-thrillers. Dearest Bothist, he wrote,
uh-huh,
I discovered my Chillpack Hollywood Hour about a year ago and always have a little quiver of excitement when a new episode pops into my world.
So thank do we. You. Yeah.
As documentarians, we're now documentarians.
Wow. I thought I was an astrologist.
I wondered if you would chat about the latest trend of mixing genres and, in my opinion, fact and fiction in documentaries. I did not like The Cove or Man on Wire because I felt the facts were blurred by quick cutting, shaky handheld shots, and dramatic music. Was I watching a documentary or the latest Mission Impossible?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Peter Watkins, the war game Culloden, used Brechtian devices to force the audience to intellectually consider his themes, whereas a great many of the recent documentaries that I have seen merely manipulate the emotions through one-sided constructive narrative that spoon feed rather than intrigue.
Mm-hmm.
Dean Haglund, go. We love these films. So.
We love these films. I'm thinking of Man on the Wire, both in our top 10 list, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And I do recall now that the instance where they're sneaking around the bodyguard was reenacted. Then they put that in to sort of heighten that tension of finally getting up to the footage they had of all the news crews filming them up there. Crossing in between the two towers, right? And it did take me out a bit to go, oh, right, they had to go, and they're manufacturing a lot of this documentary to build that dramatic tension. However, if they didn't, if it's like, hey, here's this guy who crosses this wire on these buildings, I don't know if I would have watched it. So by storytelling, by taking the elements of storytelling and taking me to documenting a actual event, I'm again torn. This is my my day of tornness.
Well, does it have to be again this or that?
Well, truly, I think this and that.
Well, exactly. I think that, as we've said with criticism before, do not. We always leap to criticizing something for what it's not,
right?
Rather than for what it is.
Uh-huh.
In the sense of art, you know. First, approach the film on the film's terms. What rules is the film setting up?
Yeah.
How does the film play by its rules? Assess what it is before approaching what it isn't. So a documentary, no different than anything else, is telling a story.
Yeah.
Than any other kind of film. Is it an interesting story? Is it artfully told? I mean, the ultimate expression of this dichotomy that you're talking about, of course, is Triumph of the Will. Yeah. Leni Riefenstahl.
Right.
Right? Anyone who says that it's not art, you know, is completely beholden to the opinion that it's propaganda.
Right.
And not artful. You watch it as a piece of photography.
Spectacular.
It's art.
Yeah.
And of course, its influence is huge.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't have modern advertising without Leni Riefenstahl.
So, what
I would say. He's absolutely right about it being a new genre.
Yeah.
Docu-thrillers. And good for them being a new genre. There's nothing wrong with that. Is it a documentary or is it Mission Impossible? I've even said about both Man on Wire and The Cove, one of the reasons I love them so much, they're the best thrillers I've seen in years.
Right.
You know what? I like thrillers. If narrative filmmakers were actually making good thrillers, maybe I wouldn't enjoy Man on Wire or The Cove so much. Maybe I would go, okay, you know, I want just a thoughtful, straight ahead documentary about this. Instead, it is rewarding. These are fun movies in that sense of viscerally exciting.
Yes.
Now, so there's that level.
But there's manipulation.
Okay. So there's that level.
Okay.
So now you're going to criticize it for rules that you believe should apply to documentaries.
Well,
I made Karl Rove, I Love You.
Yes.
A fictional documentary, and when we would say it wasn't a mockumentary, it was fictional documentary.
Okay.
People would say, "Oh, but it's scripted," and that bothered me so much because I would point out to everyone every documentary is scripted. I've now been vindicated to a certain degree by the fact that the Writers Guild actually gives an award each year: best screenplay, documentary.
Right, right.
They are written.
They are,
and the point of view to which they're written depends wildly on every documentary based on what the funding source is, based on, of course, the agenda of the person who made it. And agenda has such negative connotations. Truthfully, it's a neutral word. My agenda is this. My aim is this. That helps structure it. There's so many things that go into it. I wish that we, wouldn't constantly think that documentary ever has meant nonfiction.
Right. Right. Because I'm thinking of the documentary Brother's Keeper, My Brother's Keeper. The upstate New York backwood farmer boys that were accused of murder. They all lived together. They were like weird and creepy in the small town. And you see them go through this trial and they're emotionally ill-equipped to deal with the modern world. They stay in the small town. And the town sort of protects these boys as they go through this trial. And the whole time I'm thinking of this, I'm going, well, who's the coroner that has accused them of murder in the first place? And you don't see him till late in the third act, and you realize he's this idiotic coroner who should never have even been given the degree of coroner, if that's a degree. And so here the filmmakers set that up, and if they brought that, the footage of him testifying in court and you realize that he's a complete idiot up front, it would have dissipated the whole movie. And yet they built it up to make that guy look like such a complete dork that I was thinking, wow, that was the first time I saw that kind of scripting in the documentary. And at the same time, it was highly entertaining. It was a very successful documentary in the early 90s.
Yeah, I think that fundamentally any successful, truly successful film, when you think of it in terms of, artistically successful and culturally successful, as opposed to financially or this, but artistically and culturally, it's inspiring questions to be asked.
Right.
So, Paul, clearly these movies worked, and you're proof that they worked, because you're asking questions that aren't just about the movies themselves, but are about how we approach movies and how we process what is coming to us. You were becoming actively engaged in it, so those movies are working.
Right, whether you'd like or pissing you off, whatever.
And because most movies don't inspire questions like that. So good for the filmmakers for doing that. Also, I think, you've got to ask, what is it in a documentary that they are attempting to document?
Mm-hmm.
It's maybe in The Cove, if you proceed from the assumption that they're trying to document the slaughter of these animals, okay, I would ask, or are they documenting what this one man's life is like,
right,
who crusades against the captivity and slaughter of dolphins? And are they effectively documenting what his life is like? Certainly Man on Wire. If they're trying to document what it was like to be in the process, the creative process, and the sense of freedom, and capture that,
right,
you know, of this man who accomplished this feat, and the feelings that inspired that,
yeah,
then that puts their approach in a much different light. If you, what you're trying to document is something about the heart of the person, that requires a different approach than ideas.
Yeah.
You know, the intellect versus the emotions. If what you're trying to reveal is the heart of a man, you know, Tolstoy said we can never know history because we can never know a man.
Mm.
You know, the best that stories can aim to do is open your heart to what the heart of another is like. And then I'm not saying that The Cove or Man on Wire works under those terms, but I am saying that that shifts your approach to it.
Right.
And again, another proof, though, of how wonderful these films are is that you can come at it from so many different perspectives.
Right.
And the same person, Dean Haglund, for example, can come at it from one perspective that bothers them.
Right.
About that film. They can come at it from another perspective that pleases them about the
visually,
film.
Visually, that sort of thing, yeah.
Or even emotionally, even or even emotionally. Viscerally. Or even not a documentary, but the movie JFK.
Right.
Doesn't this embody these questions too? You know, it was not truthful. Oh, they curbed the facts on this. Oh, that's preposterous. All this. Okay. I would say yes, yes, yes to all of your criticisms. And that film is so much fun.
Yeah.
That is so artfully told.
Yeah,
there
yeah.
is so much pleasure to be taken from that film that if you boo it, you boo Santa Claus. And don't get me wrong, sometimes I boo Santa Claus.
Santa Claus needs booing now.
That movie, nothing that it got wrong bothered me to the point that I couldn't enjoy all the many myriad and deep pleasures of the film.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so that's true with both The Cove and Men on Wire. And I said that about The Cove when we first reviewed it. You know, and this gets back to kind of what we were discussing before about removing yourselves from the debate and getting to some underlying truth. I find myself watching The Cove and going, well, they don't effectively support this argument at all.
Right.
They don't give me any intellectual reason at all to hang my hat on what they're arguing here. I can't go with them here. I can't go with them. But the one thing you can't escape is the idea that needlessly wasting resources, needlessly slaughtering life,
right,
is bad behavior.
That's bad behavior. Bad juju. Bad karma. Yeah.
So, again, so, Paul, we thank you for your question, and we point out that your very question itself shows the fundamental importance of movies like the ones that you're, you know, and because, again, you need to have that. You need to have ones that are pushing the boundaries, that are creating the new genres, so that you're asking, well, wait a minute, what is a documentary? What do we expect from documentaries?
What's
what
our assumptions
is fiction
about
versus
the whole
not fiction?
Yeah.
And I would always be careful. I would caution you, Paul, in watching these things about, you know, this idea of, you know, intellect versus emotion. And of course, I am right there with him in some ways, because we live in a culture so much where it's all about fear or hope.
Yep.
Who's offering fear? Who's offering hope?
I'm hope. You're
fear. As if there's a difference between those at all. They're two sides of the same
sanity
damn coin,
yeah,
or they're the same side of two different coins. But
what?
But, you know, and no reason. There's no reasoning. There's no, what happened to rationality?
Right.
I'm right there with you. As our other listener, Phil Sternwise, once wrote in reference to, you know, Avatar, you know, when you point out all the flaws of the film, so often people's response would be, yeah, but I really love the themes that's being expressed.
Right.
And he would say, you know, well, you know what you call it when a story is not artful and it's all about but just the importance of the themes, you call that propaganda.
Ah. Look at that.
So, again, interesting. Open, you know, we can disagree with the message and still appreciate the beauty.
It's true.
And wouldn't that be nice if we could get there with each other? Where we can disagree with the message and appreciate the beauty.
Wow.
So, anyway, I loved this question. Great question.
Keep sending them in.
Thanks, Paul.
And you know where to send them.
I mentioned Phil Sternwise, and he sent us a question.
He did?
Yeah, a great question, and this is right up your alley.
Well, I have an alley.
From the Tron movie trailer.
Oh, yeah.
You see how they reduce Jeff Bridges in age.
Yes.
And they do it quite well.
I think so.
You know, it looks like he's 35 again. It looks good. It looks real. And Phil's question, you know, as opposed to, say, Patrick Stewart in X-Men 3, he pointed out, which looked terrible.
That was just bad lighting, I thought.
His question was, would you be impressed, excited, or simply aggravated if they decided to say, let's do a new James Bond movie with one of the older actors?
Like put Sean Connery in and just de-age him?
De-age him, yeah. And, you know, from an acting standpoint, you know, Dean, how would you feel about that? You know, the obvious example right now, of course, the nightmare version of this would be, you know, going back and, you know, you'd get Humphrey Bogart starring in movies again.
Yeah, right.
But because of the manipulation and the possibilities of that.
Totally.
But you know, the kind of the fun one that we could all get behind, because again, it's never yes, no. You know, we all kind of, those of us who are Star Trek fans,
yeah,
even though he died and even all this, we all kind of want to see Shatner in another Star Trek movie. And yet the question is just so, like, how do they do it? How can they do it?
Yeah.
Oh, maybe this technology points out a way that they can do it, and would we be okay with it then?
Yeah. But at the same time, you're right with an actor resonating with his character. You know, there's a time in one's life, as you've often pointed out, that you do the character very well because it's resonating with something in you in your life at that time. And as you get older and you go repeat and revisit that character, then that part of your life has maybe moved on and you're not resonating with that anymore. And that may then, even if you're de-ageified through After Effects, Amaya, whatever, computer software, you still have to bring that connection to the role. And if you're really forcing that or trying to remember how it was when you were in your 30s, it'd be...
There's so many problems with it because you're... Yeah, every actor brings baggage to a role.
Yeah.
Everyone, even an unknown. The baggage they come is, oh, I wonder if this person can act. How come I don't know this person? If they were any good, why wouldn't I know them?
What have they done?
Know, even that is baggage.
But,
you know, Sean Connery, you know, is he believably being the young Sean Connery? There's no guarantee that he would be. He would have grown different from the character.
Yeah.
So you go, is he believably the young Sean Connery? And even then, is he believably the young James Bond?
Right.
And also, I think fundamentally, you know, again, acting is about embodying, and the energy is different.
Yes.
The energy is different. And I've said this before, I wanted Clive Owen to be James Bond. I thought he was perfect. Then I saw Casino Royale, and I liked Daniel Craig because of Layer Cake, but I thought Clive Owen would be better because of the darkness and the world weariness and the cynicism that he has versus what I saw in Daniel Craig. And then I saw Casino Royale, and I went, oh, it's James Bond before he really gains that world-weary cynicism. Yeah. And you know what? Clive Owen would have been wrong for that film because 42-year-old Clive Owen has a different physical energy than 38-year-old Daniel Craig.
Yeah.
And the difference in physical energy between a 38-year-old and a 42-year-old man is noticeable.
Noticeable.
Again, not good or bad, just different.
Just older.
And so you can't CGI the energy.
That's true.
Also, something you've said, I think, about a lot, which is the danger of stunt casting.
Yeah.
Can be distracting.
Yeah, absolutely.
You might be watching this trailer and seeing Jeff Bridges. Oh, my God, he looks 35. We haven't seen the film. We don't know how distracting that is. Are you sitting there going, I wonder how they did that? Oh, my God, it's amazing how they did that. Oh, by the way, what just happened in that scene?
Yeah, exactly. I haven't been watching. Yeah.
Is it distracting? There would be such a pleasure of Shatner in a scene as Kirk that the stunt is rewarded in a cameo sense. it would be rewarded. But really, the ultimate stunt casting is Sean Connery playing the lead in another James Bond film.
Yeah.
And it could really be distracting. So I just think it'd be dangerous. And then, of course, also, you'd lose something really beautiful that comes from the stage, the tradition of the stage, which is the same script is not a fixed thing.
Right.
Even if the words are not changed.
It's malleable.
Directors and actors bring different interpretation. Storytelling is an interpretive art.
Yeah.
As much, if more so, than it is, quote unquote, a creative art in the sense of giving, of birthing something new.
A voice.
It is interpreting.
Yeah.
Because even once something is birthed, it then has to be interpreted by so many artists to bring this to fruition.
Hmm.
And
you know, that's the case of point with both our experiences of Behanding in Spokane, the Broadway show with Christopher Walken and Sam Rockwell. When we compared the final scene, mine was a big comedy laughs and yours was touching and poignant.
Right.
And obviously two different things happened on the nights we both saw that, a couple months apart?
Right.
And that the actors went through an experience live and related that through the text. The text was the same, and yet you and I had completely different experiences about
this
show.
I thought about this in sitting in with the meeting yesterday about structured, scripted improv comedy to this animated series that you're a part of. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking just, you know, about how exciting it is because I am a director and I'm a writer and at times I've performed, but I don't have that performance process in me. And what I find so exciting from being on the other side of the table or from the other side of the camera or whatever is when you bring together people with such different processes.
Yeah.
And of course, this is not just true in film. I mean, it's true in politics and education and any field.
Accounting.
What do you do as a leader when you're responsible for the hiring? Do you want people whose processes are the same, who are all going to be moving in the same direction, or do you want people with different processes? Well, guess what? There are pitfalls to both.
Yeah.
There are potential payoffs to both.
Yeah.
If you have people who all have the same processes moving in the same direction, that's great. If that was the right direction. If not, there is no hope.
There's nothing you can do.
Right.
Because everybody's going that way.
Meanwhile, if you have people with many wildly different processes, well, the pitfalls are probably more numerous. There are more ways that can go off the rail. What's interesting, though, is the failures in those cases.
Right.
Are often more interesting than other people's successes. Certainly interesting from a standpoint of being educational in nature.
Yeah.
And so that's always the question, right? And why I bring it up with this is it just occurred to me while listening to you, Sean Connery, as an actor at 80 or however old he 80 is.
80 something.
Might have a much different process than Sean Connery at 36 had, or 32, and the process might be a major part of what brings you to the destination.
Yeah.
So that destination might never be possible.
Mm-hmm.
It has less to do with how you look
right.
than with the process. And of course, we've seen this in films. We've seen actors who are too old for parts, and you still believe them.
Yeah.
Because their process got them to somewhere believable.
Kevin Spacey doing Bobby Darin.
The film might not have worked, but his process as an actor worked to get him.
Yeah, absolutely.
There, boy, we so much again that we didn't get to
the last 5 minutes of our show.
You know, again with you know, we joked a lot about many different things, but you know, it is again National Domestic Violence Month.
Oh yes.
And
how do I be aware of that?
Well, I at the same time as this, you know, the Trevor Project. With which I've been involved in the past, and of course my dear friend Dan Butler has been involved as the first, openly homosexual actor on television when he was on Frasier, became very actively involved in different groups and again suicide prevention groups. You know, the Trevor Project has become much more in the public light over the last couple weeks in the wake of a spate of suicides,
right.
And And, you know, again, this is one of the things that has driven me towards wanting to make a film about this, because, as I said 2 years ago, I see this becoming a greater and greater epidemic in our society of suicide, and of people feeling that they're alone, and feeling pressure against them. And and anyway, you know, the Trevor Project does a great deal of work in reaching out to you know, homosexual and transgender and youths and individuals in society.
They have a website?
And well, of course, the Trevor Project has a website. Oh, ever, who doesn't have a website these days, Dean?
My dog.
I have a website for, no, your dogs have websites.
Do they? Damn them.
And anyway, you know, we talked about, I talked about how much I love Project Runway, right? And,
yeah, yeah.
And Tim Gunn. And Tim Gunn did one of these videos, a series of videos that the Trevor Project's producing called It Gets Better.
As
messages to young people going, you know, I know this is really hard. Know that it gets better. And in this, he very bravely talked about when he was 17 and tried to kill himself. And anyway, and I was thinking about, you know, again, what I said on Project Runway, one of the things that I love so much about that show is that here's a show that really is all about the importance of criticism and it expanding us and enlarging us and the artfulness of criticism. You know, in our society, we talked last week about the problems in education and you know, people just can't take criticism anymore. Right. You know, and when teachers get into trouble, you know, if they criticize
a student,
the student's work or the student, most importantly, the student's behavior.
Right.
You know, then there's charges of, oh, you're a bully.
Right, right.
You're a bully, right?
You're being mean, yeah, diminishing.
And bullying, you know, let's get to the heart of this. It is not criticism if you are criticizing someone for what they are. That is not criticism.
Right.
That's bullying. That's meanness. That's aggression. That's violence.
Yeah.
Behavior, work, expression, let's hold the bar higher for each other. Let's constantly do that. And criticism is one of the best ways to do it. Let's never attack someone for what they are. You know, that is not criticism. And the reason that I bring this up is there was a headline about this political figure in New York criticizing homosexuals. The headline in the newspapers was, you know, public figure criticizes homosexuals.
Right.
And you read what he said. He wasn't criticizing them. He was calling them evil.
Right. That's not
a criticism. He was saying that they are wrong. As human beings, they are less than for being this.
Right.
That is not criticism. That's bigotry.
Right.
That's bullying. And yet this newspaper headline said he's in trouble for criticizing them. You know, let's reclaim this word and let's open ourselves as much as we can to the criticism of others. And let's also be very quick to stand up for people who, you know, are being the subjects of bullying and bigotry. And, you know, because the point of criticism is never that you are somehow less than as a person for having done this thing. It's not about humiliating. It's about saying, you know what? Your behavior was not acceptable.
Right.
And you know that. You're better than that.
And you can
be more than that.
Right.
I saw the film Gandhi this past week. I'd never watched it.
You never watched Ben Kingsley and Gandhi?
And I wonder why then, you know, 20 years, Richard Attenborough tried to get that film made about the life of Mohandas Gandhi. Never got it made. No studio ever said yes to it. He ended up cobbling together the immense financing independently.
Huge.
And thank goodness, because if he hadn't, would Ben Kingsley have been cast?
I don't know.
Unknown in his first film role have been playing Gandhi?
No.
Probably not. But and I would love to hear from anyone out there who is a fan of the film if they could explain to me why they're a fan of the film. It's not a good film. Now again, the message is critically important.
Yeah.
Did it says at the opening of the film what I said earlier. It said that the best way to approach these kind of stories is to try to reveal the heart of the person.
Right.
I don't know if it did that. I don't feel like I walked away knowing who Gandhi was, but I would love to hear from anyone that was.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, of course, it is one of those films that's completely interesting.
Yeah.
And the message is important.
Important.
You know, because here's a man who constantly talked about, you know, again, our behavior. We control our own behavior. No one else can ever control our behavior.
Right.
Because we get to control our reaction to everything. We get to control our relationship to everything. Our joy and our pain is always a result of our relationship to things, not to those things themselves. No one can cause you joy or pain. It's your relationship to that person, those words, that event, that action that causes you the joy and pain. Our power is in choosing our relationship to things, choosing our behavior to things. And, you know, he was a man who literally was a fighter. He fought. He was a soldier. And he soldiered in the belief that if you want to combat humiliation, if you want to combat violence, if you want to combat fear, you do not use humiliation, violence, or fear.
Right.
You cannot humiliate or attempt to humiliate those who are humiliating you. You cannot insult people who you feel insulted by. You cannot do that if what you are against is humiliation and violence and insult.
Right.
You have to, again, as we've said before, be the change that you want to see. And it's so hard. And it's just that, you know, again, this Trevor Project and what Tim Gunn wrote, you know, and seeing this film Gandhi all in the same week, you know, it does get better. And everybody has that power. And unfortunately, we live in a world where people are constantly telling you and making you feel you don't have power. Yeah. And you do.
You certainly do.
And on this show, you do, because this is your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. And we talk about what people ask us to talk about.
Absolutely.
And of course, my view, which sometimes isn't even my view.
Right.
It's just to, as Bill Tiller said to you one day, I just said something to try to intrigue and spark conversation.
Right, right. As always, you can find us everywhere.
And you can write to us.
And you can write to
ChillPackHollywood@yahoo.com.
That's our email.
You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/ChillPackHollywood. Become a liker.
Mm-hmm.
You can
find us on MySpace.
MySpace.com/ChillPackHollywood.
Yep.
Where you can always find the most recent episode of each show and a blog previewing the next week's show.
Just go to the website, chillpackhollywood.com.
Where you can find every show we've ever done. Download, stream, subscribe via iTunes.
Some fun. Follow us on Twitter.
He's twitter.com/dhagland.
D Hagland is me.
I'm twitter.com/PhilLairness.
Mm-hmm. And
thanks to all the people who listen to us on Jackalope Radio.
Jackalope Radio.
And as always, we're brought to you by ChillPack, the gel pack cooling device that takes your laptop computer, keeps it running fast, keeps it running smooth by keeping it cool. It's inexpensive, it's easy to use, it's environmentally friendly, and it makes a great holiday gift for the laptop computer user in your life. Check it out at chillpack.com, chillpak.com. I'm Phil Lairness.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you next week.